Uber is a story for our time, a company that gives people rides all over the world and doesn't own any of the cars. How did that happen? High tech and the sharing economy got together and took a ride together. But who's being taken for a ride? Our next guest raises that question and a bunch of others in a new book. Alex Rosenblatt is the author of Uberland, How Algorithms Are Rewriting the Rules of Work. Alex Rosenblatt holds degrees in history and sociology and works as a researcher for the Data and Society Research Institute. Her research has been covered in major publications and websites. Alex is a technology ethnographer. Alex Rosenblatt, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Jeff.
That is a fascinating title. So you cover how technology affects people and societies?
I do. I look at how Uber brings the culture of Silicon Valley to the world of work and where that can clash, because we're all familiar with free services we consume through online platforms like Facebook or Google, but we might have different expectations when the same practices or the same way that Facebook treats us as users is the same way that Uber might treat its drivers.
That is a really big change in society when you put it that way, the idea that we do expect so many things for free now.
We do. And the interesting thing is, it's really hard to identify harm when you're consuming a free service. But, you know, a lot of people come to use technology platforms with certain expectations. You know, the platforms we use, like Facebook newsfeed or Google search results, they narrate their platforms as neutral, sort of just objectively surfacing material we want to consume, whether it's news or information, through algorithms. And algorithms have a mathematical valence. You know, they're narrated as neutral, but sometimes we get a glimpse of exactly how we might be manipulated. A really good instance of this came up when Facebook started experimenting with the emotional states of its users by displaying sadder posts to some and happier posts to others to illustrate whether or not there was a contagious effect of emotions. And there was an outcry from users because they sort of were told this story, like, these platforms are neutral, you know, what you see is just like what you want to see, it's personalized, and yet they were the subject of emotional experiments. You don't really expect that. But when you look at Uber, Uber will also experiment with the wages, for example, the drivers earn. And when it comes to work, we have a greater sense that you shouldn't be taken for a ride, like you should know the terms of your engagement. And being experimented on has a very different connotation.
It really does. And, you know, given all the different facets of this, how did you manage to cram all of this into a book that checks in at under 400 pages?
I had some editing help.
Oh, good. Good, good. So let's talk about the subtitle, How Algorithms Are Rewriting the Rules of Work. And algorithms basically are programs that identify. I mean, they track things and make assumptions and then make decisions based on those assumptions, right?
They're basically rules encoded in software.
Mm-hmm. All right, so you're saying that algorithms are changing work. People aren't changing work. Algorithms are changing work.
I think algorithms are changing the relationships that we have in the workplace.
Mm-hmm.
And to give you an example, Uber drivers don't have a human supervisor they turn to when a passenger harasses them on the road or when they're missing payment for one of their trips. They are managed by algorithms that enact the rules they should follow, and when they do run into trouble, they actually email, or even now they can call a customer support line. And it would be, for the first couple of years of my research, it would be like a driver would experience a problem and they would write to a remote customer service agent who could be located in the Philippines. And they'd have to go back and forth like five or six times. So you have this pairing between an algorithm that actually enacts the rules drivers have to follow while they are working, such as the rules for how they can request or reject rides. And then you have a remote customer service agency that, you know, tries to buffer some of the problems that happen. What you're missing there are human managers who you might turn to resolve problems at the workplace.
So, not to put too fine a point on it, but essentially you have people being managed by artificial intelligence.
I don't know if it's always artificial intelligence. I mean, sometimes there are, you know, machine learning processes that go into some of how wage experiments or price experiments might play out. But you have, you know, Uber can set the pay rates, for example, and the algorithms can enforce those pay rates. And you might also apply, for example, Uber's surge pricing algorithm, and that affects both what passengers pay and what drivers earn. The surge pricing algorithm basically multiplies the cost of a ride when the demand for drivers outstrips the supply of them in a local area. And the idea is that you'll, as a driver, be incentivized to relocate to a particular place at a particular time. And here's where the management part of it comes in. Drivers might be in another area of town, they might be nearby, but they get a lot of messages because actually an app-based, you know, workplace can monitor your behavior in much more granular ways than even a human supervisor could. So they know when you're about to log out and they could intervene and send you a message, don't log out now, demand is really high, you know, urging you to stay online and relocate to a surge pricing area with the prospect that you might earn more. And here's where it gets really interesting, because basically what you're getting are algorithmic recommendations. And we're familiar with this as consumers of Netflix, for example. You might get a recommendation for the next rom-com you want to watch. And if you don't enjoy that rom-com, the stakes are pretty low. But when your manager tells you, you know, we recommend you relocate to this place at this time and you'll earn a premium, and then you don't, because, for example, that same boss dispatches you a ride at the same rates, or because you... the surge pricing might disappear by the time you arrive, that has a different impact. That's when you're playing with people's livelihoods.
Okay, so, the manager who's always with you, in a sense. The research sounds exhaustive and maybe exhausting. How many rides in how many cities, Alex?
Well, I've been to over 25 cities between 2014 and 2018 across the U.S. and Canada, because I'm Canadian, and so I always like to bridge those two locations. And I've also ridden over 5,000 miles. I went into just the production of this book, although I'm sure I've ridden more since. And beyond my experiences as an ethnographer, riding along with drivers and basically learning from strangers, I've also spent a great deal of time in online forums. Because while drivers don't have any way to talk to other drivers within the app, they don't have a radio, for example, they did constantly run up against a barrier in this algorithmic management system, which is that they didn't have all the information they needed to do their jobs well or to handle anything that was sort of outside the norm. And so they turned to online forums, not all of them, of course, but some of them. And there's groups online, Facebook groups, dedicated driver websites with hundreds of thousands of drivers.
So it's become like the water cooler. This is where the employees get together to talk about the bosses.
Yes, it's exactly like that, except it's really about information sharing, just because, you know, they come to these places because they don't know what to do and a passenger harasses them.
All right, we need to come back and talk more with Alex Rosenblatt about Uberland when we come back from this break here on the Jefferson Exchange. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. If you've taken a ride in an Uber, maybe you didn't talk to the driver, but Alex Rosenblatt talked to a lot of Uber drivers for her book, Uberland, How Algorithms Are Rewriting the Rules of Work. And we're getting an idea of what it's like to be, are you an entrepreneur? Are you an employee? What exactly is it when you're working for the likes of Uber? Alex is a technology ethnographer and has talked to a lot of people for this book. You can join the conversation on the Exchange about the changing rules at the workplace, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Alex, you write that a culture of shaky and insecure work in precarious times shapes the dynamics of driving for Uber. Does the perception of a booming economy not reach the drivers?
Well, when Uber got started, it was really banking off of the dregs of the Great Recession, when a lot of people needed a job or a source of quick employment or income. A lot of people had lost their homes. There were massive foreclosure crises. There, you know, things were pretty terrible. And Uber came along and said, look, we've got this technology and we can scale entrepreneurship for the masses. And by the way, you could be making upwards of $90,000 a year. And that seems like a pathway to the middle class, a very desirable end goal in the dregs of the Great Recession. And at that point, that's how working for Uber was narrated across the media. And it turns out that drivers have a discretionary income, you know, after accounting for all of their expenses and the mandatory taxes they have to pay, you know, to like $10.87 an hour, according to Lawrence Michel at the Economic Policy Institute. And so there's a real gap that's emerged over the years between the initial promise and what drivers can expect to make, which of course varies from place to place. And so it could be that in a boom employment time, there are fewer people cycling through the app. But even within the employment history of Uber, churn is really high. You know, after 6 months, about 68% of the workforce is turning over, and it's a little higher for women. And so it's not only that the larger context of work has been about fissuring and precarity and, you know, more independent contractors, more subcontracting in general, it's also that within the employment conditions that Uber sets for its drivers, there's a very high turnover rate, in part because it takes time to figure out what you're really earning after all of your expenses and to know what's really happening with the rules of the road. It's really easy to get started. You can be hired in under a week, but it's harder. It takes a longer time to figure out what's really going on.
So I wonder if you were able to talk to people who are former Uber drivers who had gotten out and figured out the reasons that they had gotten out and how much happier or not they were post-Uber.
I did interview some people who had already moved on, and they, you know, one of them in California said he was working, you know, every single day. He hadn't spent a Friday night with his wife in like a year. He was on the verge of a divorce, and he then got his dream job, you know, working for a beer company, actually. And, it, you know, Uber was, in a sense, a stopgap solution for him that was quite valuable. But at the same time, because he always had to, work at the hours where there were peak demand under sort of market conditions, he didn't have any of the stability of a schedule or guaranteed pay unless he was responsive to the prompts and incentives that Uber provided. And so you get this sort of shaky balance between what you can tolerate and what, you know, where you might want to also move on to the next stage.
The book does include up front some myths upon which you say Uber is constructed. And one of them is there's a myth you see in the sharing economy itself. What is that?
Well, Uber narrated its rise as part of the sharing economy, and it wasn't the only one. Airbnb and others said, look, we're actually having platforms that can connect everybody, and people can use their underutilized assets or skills to make money, to get jobs quickly. And that was really appealing, especially, of course, after the Great Recession. And so the platforms came in and said, look, like, we're just connective tissue. You know, like, everyone's going to be an independent contractor, and we're just going to connect a passenger who needs a ride with a driver who can provide one, who will be contributing, you know, to the community of riders. Of course, the sharing rhetoric draws on a longer history of collaborative commerce. So we think about carpooling, for example, or couch surfing. But of course, that was a myth. It's not that, of course, people do have altruistic intentions when they want to share their couch with a passing traveler or a friend, of course, but what Uber was actually providing was a source of, like, an employment opportunity. And it's not that a driver is just doing this to, like, share their car. People depend on this for their income and for their livelihoods and to support their kids. And by narrating it as a form of sharing, of just simply of connecting with a community, Uber and others drew on a longer history of devaluing women's work because it narrated it as a social contribution. You know, women aren't compensated for the work they do at home, caring for family or friends or community, and by calling this type of work sharing as well, it undermined the idea that drivers were entitled to fair compensation.
There's another myth you frame here. The book, again, is called Uberland, How Algorithms Are Rewriting the Rules of Work. Alex Rosenblatt is the author and our guest. Another myth you frame here is called technological exceptionalism, which is a fascinating idea. What is that?
That's when tech companies will say the regular rules of the industry we're in don't apply to us. For example, Facebook, which is like the biggest news distributor, claims it's not a media company, it's a technology company. And Uber similarly said, we're not a taxi company or a transportation company, you know, we're a technology company. And they would leverage that identity to say, for example, that they don't need to provide accessible transit for disabled passengers or wheelchair users. And so you saw this emergence of an identity where they could say, look, we do sort of a similar thing that you're familiar with. We provide a ride from A to B for hire, but we're actually different because we're just like a connective tissue, kind of like a credit card processor. When in fact, when you look under the hood, Uber has actually created a system of algorithmic management, and it can take advantage of its role as a middleman by, for example, charging some passengers what they're willing to pay rather than market rates. And it has a much stronger role than the kind of invisible one that it narrated.
Let's take a call here. We have John in Grants Pass on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Alex Rosenblatt, the author of Uberland.
Oh, hi. Thanks. Maybe you covered this already, but what about the taxi industry, the traditional cab? Cost-wise, what's the difference? I imagine there is, and about how quick they get there. And about do taxis feel threatened, I guess. Oh, and then one other thing, When I was in Los Angeles last week, they have these scooters now that you pay for. They're just sitting around on the streets. One's called Lime, and I wonder if that's a similar sort of in, I don't know if it's an invention, but anyway, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, Portland is doing the e-scooter thing with Lime at the moment, too. So, yeah, a couple of different ways to get around. And you did go to cities like New York where the taxis are heavily regulated, which brings to the question, how did Uber manage to gain a foothold in that town? So the taxi and other transportation question here.
So using its exceptional identity as a technology company, Uber entered new markets where there were heavily regulated taxi industries and just places where they weren't as regulated, but there was still, you know, rules that applied, and said, these rules don't apply to us because we're a technology company, not a taxi company. And it used that to create a distinction. But in fact, in New York City, Uber was a regulatory anomaly. Like, the New York Taxi and Limousine Commission maintained its foothold on Uber and Lyft and other ride-hail companies, and drivers have to go through an application process to get TLC license plates, for example, and to go through. And they have to basically put upfront costs there, get a TLC license plate, get commercial insurance. Like, the standards are very different in a regulated environment than across many other cities I've been to in Uberland. But I'd say the comparison to taxis is actually more interesting to me in one other aspect, which is that I would go to cities where Uber wasn't yet legitimate or legal in its operations, but it would have an underground, and drivers would risk themselves on the Uber underground because the opportunity was a more desirable one. Uber would have their back. If you went to Montreal, for example, before they enacted a permit program to make Uber legitimate, drivers had to sort of work underground because the taxis were aggressive towards them and protesting them, and the transportation police would ticket them and maybe impound their vehicles, and Uber would pay their fines and potentially replace their vehicles when they were impounded for a temporary period of time. And so Uber developed an alliance with drivers against the sort of legitimate taxi force. But over time, we can see that changing. And a really good example of that brings us back to New York, where although taxis and Uber were initially kind of at odds with each other, I think there's now a greater recognition that they're all, you know, drivers in a market that might be flooded where they at least need a base floor. And so the New York TLC, because it had a regulatory foothold, was able to rely on the data it can demand from companies and on its own city charter to say, okay, we're going to propose a minimum wage floor, you know, so that this can be a sustainable job for many. And that was in response to the sort of declining conditions of work for the taxi industry that, you know, was one of the effects of Uber's dominant rise. You had a rash of suicides in taxi drivers in New York, and there was just this moment where people said, okay, like, we're a little bit on the same page here. This is no longer Uber versus taxi. This is how can we create a sustainable living wage for drivers.
Alex Rosenblatt is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a technology ethnographer, and so she took a lot of rides and a lot of Ubers and even some Lyfts for the book Uberland, How Algorithms Are Rewriting the Rules of Work, the way in which the relationship between boss and worker are not the same, especially when the boss, at least part of the time, is an algorithm that's giving you some direction. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Lots of different reasons why people drive, you point out, from you know, I got to do this to make money, to I just want to want a little extra money, I do this for fun. And so within that range, though, what got people in the first place? You do report an allure of entrepreneurship that Uber tends to put out front.
Well, I think for drivers, the motivation to start could be different. It could be that they had a friend. It could be that they were already passengers who used the services. Tedeschi was a ride-hail customer before he began driving for Lyft in Washington, D.C., and he was considering Uber at the time that I spoke with him. And he was like, you know, I ride all the time. After I have a few drinks, I don't like to drive. I just call a Lyft and I talk to the drivers. And then, you know, a few friends started driving too, and so I decided to try it out. And this would be one way that drivers would come in. But there's also referral codes that incentivize them to recruit other drivers. And so they get like a kickback if they do recruit other people into it. Some people started driving for Uber or other ride-hail services because their small business went under. You know, and so early on, I would sort of ask drivers, do you feel like an entrepreneur because you drive for Uber? And they were like, what? Like, there was sort of a gap between the rhetoric that Uber was promoting to narrate its image and its contribution to society and to sort of justify why it was an exception to the rules as a technology company. And then there were drivers who might have needed a little bit of extra money. The scheduling flexibility certainly has broad appeal. So Karen was a driver I met in New Orleans, and she had a son, or has a son, who has a chronic medical condition. And she'd worked in the service industry for a long time, and this was just like another service job to her. And she liked it because if her son had an episode, she could be responsive to him right away without having to deal with like switching shifts with someone, for example.
So do these people ultimately feel like they're their own bosses, or do they, I mean, I imagine there are just many differences in how people feel about the way they're managed as there are in any other workplace.
I think a lot of drivers appreciate feeling more independent at work, but I'd say that they aspire to a higher degree of independence than they have. And this is where it gets tricky, because although you don't have a human supervisor looking over your shoulder, you do have this app that's collecting constant data on your behavior, from the ratings you get from customers to how quickly you accelerate, how harshly you brake, and the boss will send a message, evaluating your driving or alerting you that you might be deactivated because a passenger complained about you. Deactivate is a technology word that just means suspended or fired. And so there's this tension that exists between the control that Uber can leverage over how you behave at work and the fact that, you know, there's no human supervisor gives a degree of independence or feels more independent. And Uber also classifies drivers as independent contractors. You know, so there's always this tension that exists. One that has given rise to employment misclassification lawsuits around the world, where some drivers will, you know, sue Uber and also Lyft and say, look, you control so much of what we do. You control the rates. You set them by yourself. I only have the power to charge a lower fare, not a higher one. I can't build client lists. You know, you can fire me on a whim. Like, I don't feel very much like an entrepreneur. I don't feel like I have the independence here. And so they'll sue and say, we've been misclassified, and, you know, maybe we should be classified as employees, and then we're entitled to a minimum wage, for example. So this tension exists, like, across the board.
Alex Rosenblatt, in writing Uberland, you did talk to Uber, and in fact, not always pleasantly. What was the phantom car finding that you publicized, and how did Uber respond?
You know, one night about 2 a.m., a driver named Heather was checking her passenger app, because drivers would actually use the passenger app to scout out the local competition. You can see those little black sedans there and how many are nearby. And she noticed that there were four sedans accrued outside her home, which was kind of a remote area, not like a dense, busy urban place. And the app also indicated that the nearest driver was 17 minutes away, which was really strange because there were all these sedans clustered right next to her pickup location on the screen. So she looks outside her window, and there's no cars there, you know, and so it was clear that there was a discrepancy. So she writes in to Uber support and gets an unusually frank answer where they explain, you know, just to her that these are really just more of a visual effect, the little black sedans you see on your screen. They do not reflect the accurate number of cars or their location that exist in real life. Think of it more as a screensaver. And so I contacted Uber's PR and, you know, asked them about this, and they said, yes, like, these cars do, in fact, reflect the general location and number of them. And so I had this sort of correspondence, and I had these screenshots, and I had Uber's counter response, and I published an article about Uber's phantom cabs, that the cars you see on your screen don't necessarily reflect the real number or location of cars. And it went viral because it was such a successful example of dark design, where you fudge the location of drivers because perhaps it will incentivize passengers to choose an Uber car over a taxi or a Lyft. But as it turns out, this example of dark design, where you sort of manipulate expectations through the screen, turned out to be a prescient one because it was the underlying idea behind a grand effort to deceive regulators who were trying to crack down on Uber about the location of those cars. And so Mike Isaac at the New York Times actually revealed this much more systematic use of it in a program called Grayball.
So we have about a minute left here, Alex, and I just want to get to something of an overview here, which is whether the Uber model works for anybody else, or if it even works for Uber, for that matter, and its people. Is there any other industry or business making the same model work for it, and is it any better for workers?
I think that other industries have certainly tried to create the Uber for X. You know, we've seen we saw a number of startups make that effort, and even just some of the features exist across other industries as well, like care and cleaning work will have rating systems and like messaging functions, but they might act more like a marketplace where people have to make the connections with their clients themselves, message back and forth a bunch of times, whereas Uber actually very successfully just dispatches jobs. You can log in and get jobs right away. So, there's similar features across different industries, but Uber is actually really honed a type of algorithmic management that gets people work, even if it's not under the conditions that they would prefer. I think a lot of people are looking to Uber and saying, well, you know, if I can actually scale employment and standardize the services that my workers provide while also distancing myself from an employment relationship, like I don't have to call these workers employees, that'll save me a lot of costs. You know, so I think people are looking at the Uber model and wondering, well, can we apply this same framework to our own industries? And that's a very interesting question because Uber is thus kind of carving out a template for future workplace relationships. And as we can see across Uberland, drivers don't really have an ability to negotiate with the algorithm. So you have to wonder, like, what is a better vision we could see for how we manage workplace relationships, even in an era where you don't need a human boss?
All right. So we'll be hearing more about this for sure in the years to come. The book is called Uberland, How Algorithms Are Rewriting the Rules of Work. It's the work of Alex Rosenblatt, a technology ethnographer with degrees in history and sociology. Alex, thanks so much for joining us today on The Exchange.
A pleasure.
All right. Take care.